The content of the following program is intended for our blind and print-impaired audience. Your North Carolina Reading Service brings you the Indie Week. I'm John Federson, reading this issue, which is dated September the 14th, 2022. And we thank the John Doe Ensemble today for our music. That's a name you should all recognize, the John Doe Musical Ensemble. Thank you. We'll hear them at the end of the broadcast. And right from the start, we'll go to IndieWeek.com, which has some articles which are not in the print version, and I'll go back and forth for them. But this is about Walltown development over at Northgate Mall in Durham, and we've been reading quite a few articles about that in the past. This one by Lena Geller says, residents of Walltown neighborhood reiterated their demand for an equitable redevelopment of Northgate Mall during a community meeting last Saturday, facing off with attorneys for the mall's new owner, who touted the project as a facelift and blamed Duke University for the proposal's lack of residential space. The Walltown Community Association, WCA, has advocated for a community-centered redevelopment of that property, which is a 50-acre parcel that's larger than the downtown loop. Since it had been acquired by global real estate firm Northwood Raven in 2018, engaging more than 600 nearby residents to create a vision that includes affordable housing, affordable retail, and accessible green space. Northwood Raven's latest site plan, which features a life science research campus bordered by retail space and a one-acre public park, is missing some major components that are crucial for surrounding residents, WCA says. Though the sitemap's first iteration did not include affordable housing, it did include residential space, and the WCA had hoped the City Council would negotiate with Northwood Raven to provide some affordable housing in exchange for added density. At Saturday's meeting, attorneys Neil Ghosh and Keenan Condor pitched the redevelopment as a modest but exciting project. Condor said, it's going to make everything look more attractive, look prettier, be a community asset, especially with the green space, and ideally will bring in some more restaurants and cafes and things that people who live in this area would love to go to. He added, retailers will also provide job opportunities for you all from the neighborhood. WC member Brandon Williams pushed back on Condor's assertion that the current proposal would benefit existing residents. While any kind of a proposal, research campus or otherwise, would likely displace some residents, the current site plan, with its dearth of affordable housing, doesn't offer any opportunities for displaced residents to remain in the area. Williams said, you're going to recruit a bunch of people to come work here, and those people are going to want to live close to where they work. And given that the income brackets of surrounding neighborhoods will dictate the affordability, or lack thereof, of incoming retailers, the project's retail space wouldn't be accessible to the handful of working-class Walltown residents who don't get pushed out. Williams said, we understand there's not much you all can do about the pressure that's going to be on the neighborhood, but what we can try to do is replace that housing to give an opportunity for folks in lower income brackets to remain and be proximate. So then a retailer could see that, oh, there are folks who are in this income range right here in the property who also want to come shop here. That retailer will then want to offer those kinds of prices. Ghosh told Williams that his concerns are valid. Quote, this is a very multifaceted, complex issue, but that fitting any residential space into the redevelopment would be nearly impossible due to Duke University's ownership of the Macy's wing of the mall, a parcel that includes 900 surface-level parking spaces. Duke bought that former department store in 2017 with plans to transform it into office space and medical clinics. Ghosh said it is very difficult to add a residential component where you can't park anywhere. In order to make it work, you'd have to restructure the deal with Duke. When one resident asked how many parking spaces the rest of the site contains, Ghosh said he didn't know. To construct a life science research campus on the site, Northwood Raven must file a rezoning request to change the property's commercial center classification to commercial general. Because the request will go to the City Council for approval, the WCA has been urging council members to withhold their votes until the firm proposes a vision that furthers community interests. Williams asked Ghosh if the WCA should start petitioning Duke as well. If the university is willing to surrender some parking spaces, would that make a residential component more feasible for Northwood Raven? Ghosh said, at a surface level, I think that's essentially it. But I can't tell you all the nuances. Also from IndyWeek.com, a new website details Senate candidate Bud's corruption. Jane Porter writes this. Bud has been involved in a number of crooked deals, special interest funded travel, and financial scandals. He's also voted against the best interests of North Carolinians at most every turn. Mitch McConnell's Senate Leadership Fund is dumping $3.4 million into North Carolina's U.S. Senate race between Sherry Beasley and Ted Budd. Donald Trump is appearing at a rally with Bud in Wilmington next week, and Bud is co-sponsoring the U.S. House version of Senator Lindsey Graham's depraved abortion ban. So now seems like a good time to remind why Bud, of all candidates running in 34 contested Senate races this November, is probably the most corrupt politician vying for a U.S. Senate seat this cycle. As a new website from the North Carolina Democratic Party details, Bud has been involved in a number of crooked deals, special interest-funded travel, and financial scandals. He's also voted against the best interests of North Carolinians at most every turn. Here's a taste. Bud has consistently taken money from big banks and then voted to allow banks to charge customers high fees and stymied efforts to lower costs for regular working people. Bud and his family screwed farmers out of $50 million in an agriculture scheme that went bankrupt and left more than $1.3 million behind in tax debt. We reported on that last September. Now, I'm just parenthetically going to say that in this online article, many of the sentences I'm reading contain links. So when it talks about reports of this and that online at IndyWeek.com, one could press that link and see the details about what the writer is mentioning. Bud traveled on the special interest dime, taking a series of trips worth $30,000 to destinations like Miami, Palm Beach, and Oslo, Norway, and staying in $900 a night luxury hotels. Bud voted against legislation in July that would lower gas prices and protect consumers from price gouging by big oil companies. A day before that vote, he had taken $5,000, the legal maximum campaign contribution, from big oil PAC Continental Resources Incorporated. Days before voting against H.R. 3, the Elijah Cummings Lower Drug Costs Now Act in 2019, Bud took $2,500 from GlaxoSmithKline's PAC and $1,000 from Pfizer's. This is all in addition to siding with predatory payday lenders after taking their money, voting against funding for child abuse prevention services, voting against a bill to address the infant formula shortage, and initially voting against a bill to assist veterans. So, Bud's record is not great. Sometimes it's just helpful to keep all the corruption cataloged in one place. Now over to the print edition, which is also included, of course, on IndyWeek.com, an op-ed from Dan Blue, Democrat of Wake County, the North Carolina Senate Majority Leader. Minority Leader. The year of workforce woes. At the start of 2022, State Superintendent Kathy Truitt declared this the year of the workforce. That sentiment is well-intentioned, but Truitt and other state leaders need to focus first on the strain on the teacher workforce before we can make headway on preparing students to be a part of our state's economy. We can't possibly prepare students for the workforce when we don't have enough educators, support staff, or resources to educate and train them. Teachers are leaving the profession in droves. As devastating as that is, it should come as no surprise. Attacks on educators' professionalism, massive pay cuts, the lack of basic resources. It's no wonder teachers are turning to private sector jobs with more reliable hours, support, and pay. College students choosing to pursue teaching degrees have dropped by 50%, and North Carolina teachers earn nearly 25% less than graduates in other occupations. The writing is on the wall. Senator Phil Berger said in WRAL's documentary Leandro, The Case for a Sound Basic Education, that there is, quote, no question that students aren't getting a sound basic education. The real question is the remedy. While Republicans try to reinvent the wheel, the fact remains that schools are running out of gas. Republicans talk about school choice, and Democrats are all for school choice. But draining funding and resources from public schools creates a false choice. Republicans are setting up public schools to fail. What parent wants to send their kid to a failing school? Republicans aren't giving parents a real choice in the matter. Republicans criticized the Leandro plan by claiming we can't just throw money at a problem. That's a nice theory, but it doesn't work in the real world. Funding is what is needed to get students the resources they need to succeed and to join the workforce. Instead, Republicans have spent the past decade turning school investments into corporate tax breaks. That conservative strategy may be good enough to get that coveted best place for business title for a few years. But the lure of a zero corporate tax rate only goes so far. The total lack of investment in the next generation of workforce labor is coming back to bite us. At the recent NC Chamber of Conference on Education and Workforce, business leaders said that addressing workforce shortages requires education partnership. I would argue that addressing education shortages requires corporate partnership. I applaud business and civic leaders who filed a friend of the court brief in support of fully funding our public schools. They see beyond tax rates to the value of investing in the next generation's workforce. We need to get back to the basics and make sure every preschooler is ready for kindergarten, every teacher has paper, pencils, and support staff in their classroom, every student has a nurse, social worker or psychologist they can go to when they're in a crisis, and every high school graduate is ready to face the real world and be a contributing member of society. It's in the best interest of our business community to give parents strong choices in education. That will strengthen our economy in the long run. And next, a story from Enfield, North Carolina, by Tomasi McDonald. This month, a fiery, newly elected black mayor called on North Carolina Governor Cooper to declare a state of emergency in his overwhelmingly black town of less than 3,000 residents in the eastern part of the state. Enfield Mayor Mondale Robinson says he was targeted with death threats from the Ku Klux Klan soon after he knocked down a Confederate memorial that had stood in a public park for over 90 years. Robinson told Indy last week he received an email from the KKK warning him to watch your back. Robinson, who was elected mayor 4 months ago, said during a September 6th press conference, "We need our governor to lock arms with this community, ensuring that our solemn way of life isn't interrupted by white supremacy. Our small police force does not have the resources. The force has the needed resources for their day-to-day interaction with the community, but the added need to prevent racialized violence is beyond our capacity and must be addressed by our state." Robinson also called on the state attorney general's office to investigate the threats. A spokesperson for the government and for the governor said the Secretary of State's Department of Public Safety met with Mondale and local officials on Monday to offer assistance and hear their concerns. Quote, the governor's office, along with the attorney general's office, in consultation with the district attorney, requested the State Bureau of Investigation look into the allegations, said Mary Scott Winstead, the governor's deputy communications director. The governor condemns hate crimes and threats of violence. Robinson's startling request came in the aftermath of his decision weeks earlier to knock down a 10-foot-tall monument that was a gift to the town from the United Daughters of the Confederacy in 1928. The monument stood in Randolph Park and was originally dedicated to Confederate soldiers and veterans of World War I, according to the UNC Chapel Hill Library's Commemorative Landscapes of North Carolina collection. The memorial, according to that library, was constructed with Georgia marble and features bronze tablets. According to the library, two small walls extend from the center square, and one side supports a drinking fountain. Robinson last week told Indy that the monument rankled him even when he was a child because he understood what the Confederacy was all about, because that part of history wasn't taught in schools. There were segregated water fountains at the monument. The bowl for white people is still standing. The bowl for black people is rusted and the faucet's gone. That's how little they cared about our people. Indeed, the UNC Library notes, during segregation, the memorial featured a fountain with two drinking spouts, one for whites and one for non-whites. The fountain for non-whites has been removed, but its pedestal and spigot hole remain. More pointedly, the UNC's library description of the memorial notes the Confederate flag is carved into the marble on one side of the center column. Just beneath the Confederate flag, inscribed upon a bronze plaque, are the dates, Civil War dates, 1861, 1865, and the following. To the memory of the veterans of the war between the states, we care not whence they came, dear in their lifeless clay, whether unknown or known to fame, their cause and country still the same. They died and wore the gray. It was Sunday afternoon on August 21 when Robinson arrived at Randolph Park intending to knock the memorial down. He was armed with a household hammer. I was beating on it, but it was a formidable opponent, Robinson said. I called somebody with a tractor and we knocked that mother over in 10 seconds. Robinson says he cordoned off the toppled statue with yellow caution tape normally used at crime scenes to prevent anyone from getting hurt. Then he went home. Reaction to the toppled monument was immediate. Robinson says less than 12 hours later, I was notified that the SBI had launched an investigation that was sparked by the police chief, James Ayers. Then Ayers resigned. Mondale continued, he gave 2 weeks' notice and said it was for political reasons and me dividing, not unifying the community. But the town at large was super excited. The Indy could not reach Ayers for comment. Robinson says the death threats were immediate, too. At first, there were racist messages on Facebook, he says. Then someone put my personal information on white supremacist websites. I started getting mail at home and at my office, including a KKK call to action to do something to me. Robinson says the SBI is investigating whether he committed an unlawful act, but he says the lawful removal of the memorial was long overdue. In 2020, after the police murder of George Floyd, the town's Board of Commissioners, quote, passed a resolution to get rid of the monument. But somehow, he adds, quote, the minutes from that meeting mysteriously disappeared. Robinson easily beat the incumbent, Wayne Anderson, with more than 70% of the vote in May and was sworn in the following month. I told them we got work to do, he said of his fellow board members. When I came in, I put the monument removal on the August 15 agenda. I talked about the history of racism in this country and how trauma can be passed down and that we needed to get rid of it. The Enfield board approved removing the memorial by a 4-1 vote. The lone dissenting vote was cast by Kent Holmes. Robinson recalls Holmes objected being torn down because there were white Enfield residents who did not know the historical significance of the thing. Robinson says, I told him you don't get to determine what history is. You can't rewrite what history means. Holmes could not be reached for comment. The Indy also reached out to town commissioners Tracy Joyner, Bud Whitaker, Bobby Whitaker, and Kenneth Ward via emails and phone calls. None were available for comment. If he had been born generations before, Robinson would have been known as a race man, someone cut in the mold of William Trotter or Ida B. Wells, who both devoted their lives working for the betterment of black people. Robinson was born and raised in Enfield, a tiny hamlet in Halifax County of about 2,300 people that's about 95 miles east of Durham. Black Americans account for more than 85% of the population, and whites comprising nearly 13% and Native Americans at 2%. During its heyday, Enfield was one of the world's leading producers of raw peanuts. Today, more than 33% of its residents live below the poverty line, and the median household income is a little under $22,000 a year. Robinson was the seventh of 13 children, born to a mother who stopped school in the sixth grade and went on to earn her general education diploma, and a father with a third grade education. Robinson says, "We struggled, borrowed, and suffered. I don't know how my parents pulled that magic off." Robinson says his daddy was convicted of a felony at age 17 after beating up a white man and then leaving town after the sheriff warned him that some of the townsfolk wanted to lynch him. "When he returned, they gave him a felony conviction," Robinson says. "He did whatever he could to take care of us, paving driveways, fixing roofs, fixing cars, but we barely had enough to eat." That instability meant the Robinson family frequently moved from one home to another. "We struggled a lot," he says. "I used to laugh and joke with people. I would tell them that I lived in every house in Enfield. Holes in the floor were so common, my friends didn't blink when they came over. Some of my friends had to put a blanket up for a front door." Robinson graduated from high school and enrolled in the U.S. Marines in 1997. He was discharged in 1999 and enrolled at Catawba Valley Community College. He transferred to Livingston College, where he earned an undergraduate degree in 2009. He then enrolled in graduate school at Alabama A&M in 2011, where he studied political science. Then he enrolled at the Wake Forest University School of Divinity in 2012 and then was accepted at the University of Arkansas Law School in 2013. The same day that Robinson was set to begin law classes, he received word that one of his brothers had been murdered in Greenville. He says the school took to the back burner for sure. He says he returned to Enfield last year, but adds he never really left. Robinson says he had no intention of running for mayor, but the incumbent was ushering in gentrification. Robinson explains, "One guy came here and bought 40 properties, paying a maximum of $5,000 for each. He started tearing down the old houses and putting up houses there selling for $200,000. The poverty rate here is 40%. Unemployment, more than 30%. I'm seeing cars with Pennsylvania and New Jersey tags, and they're pushing black people from the resources in town out into the country. I decided that I need to step up and run for mayor." Robinson scoffs at the assertion that Confederate memorials like the Confederate flag are about Southern heritage and pride of place, and one's ancestors fighting for a noble cause, rather than being traitors who seceded from the United States for the ignoble cause of owning other human beings. And he says, "You can't show me a memorial in any other country that honors the enemy. Where's the memorial that honors the Japanese at Pearl Harbor? Show me the memorial that honors the Nazis in Germany. The Civil War was not about states' rights. The Southern states seceded because the North refused to uphold the Fugitive Slave Act, or the idea that black people were ordained by God to be nothing but workers and animals." And next, from Wake County, Davey Bland writes about former Wake Sheriff Donnie Harrison, who is a candidate for election again in the sheriff's office. During Donnie Harrison's tenure as Wake County Sheriff from 2002 to 2018, he embraced the 287G program, a controversial initiative that allowed his deputies to enforce certain federal immigration laws. Now, as a candidate looking to be sheriff once again, he says he won't reinstate the program. He said in an interview with Indy Week, "This is about me looking around and saying, how can I make the streets of Wake County safer?" The new attitude toward the program for the Republican candidate may seem surprising, since as recently as April he supported 287G. Bolts magazine reported, "It's not a change of heart or regrets that are altering his stance," Harrison and a spokesperson say. Instead, he says, new technology and protocols used by the jail booking agency in Wake County are, quote, just a better system. In a statement, Harrison called 287G obsolete. With a promise from President Joe Biden to end the program, the protocols of the City-County Bureau of Identification, which is not under the sheriff's purview, are the way of the future for Harrison. While the specter of 287G, which the sheriff's department hasn't used since 2018, seems to be fading in the county, and Harrison says he has no plan to bring it back if reelected, immigrant advocates and activist groups say Harrison's new position is too little, too late. That program was enacted as part of federal immigration law in 1996, but ramped up in the post-9/11 years. The program hit its peak, federal funding from 2010 to 2013, according to the American Immigration Council. The program let officers with North Carolina police agencies act as agents of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, if an agreement was signed between the two. Police officers were empowered to start the process of deporting people after ICE training. Harrison was one of the first sheriffs in North Carolina to sign up for the program in 2007. The program, Harrison says, was the closest thing I had then to see who was here and was wanted. If a person was arrested and suspected of being from another country, a 287G authorized officer inside a jail could screen the immigration status of the person by asking a series of questions, including what country they were from and checking their fingerprints in ICE databases. Those databases would tell whether a person was wanted by ICE for something like an expired visa or a green card. If a 287G officer suspected a person was an immigrant, the officer had virtually no barriers to screening them. Since ICE keeps records of every person who has immigration documents, being screened but not showing up in the ICE database flags the inmate as a possible illegal alien, according to a 2009 article on North Carolina Sheriff's Perspectives in Popular Government, a magazine published by the UNC School of Government. The Henderson County Sheriff at the time, Rick Davis, described a system susceptible to abuse, saying in that Popular Government article, "The program establishes a record on 100% of the people who come into our facility. They either have fingerprints on file or they don't. In the case where ICE doesn't have prints on file, the burden of proof is on the detainee to verify his or her identity. It's one of the rare times in U.S. law when the burden of proof is on the accused." Immigrant advocates rallied against the program, saying it was breaking up families for minor offenses, like traffic violations, and that it actually worsened crime by scaring immigrants from calling police for fear of their status being checked. The program destroyed lives so sheriffs could pander for votes with anti-immigrant politics, critics said. They also lambasted local and county police for doing the work of federal agents instead of protecting local communities. From the time Harrison adopted the program up till his Indy Week interview this month, he spoke of the program as a way to remove criminals from Wake County. He was quoted as saying in that article of 2008, "We're finding people who are wanted in other states and other counties. We're getting criminals off the street that need to be gotten off the street." The article said Harrison, quote, "takes satisfaction in knowing he's not letting a child molester or murderer back on the street." In the first 6 months of the program, the Wake Sheriff's Office sent more than 900 people who were arrested to ICE for hearings on immigration status, according to that article. In 2016 and 2017, ICE deported almost 500 people from Wake County through the program, Bolts reported, citing research by Appalachian State University sociologist Felicia Arriaga. But studies and a federal investigation found the program wasn't netting hardened criminals and confirmed what the immigrant advocates claimed. A 2010 UNC study on the program's effects in the state found that 287G had a chilling effect on Hispanic community members reporting crime and talking to police. The program was not incarcerating violent offenders, but mostly people charged with traffic violations, the study found. A U.S. Justice Department investigation concluded in 2012 that the Alamance County Sheriff's Office, which used 287G, had engaged in a pattern of discrimination against Latino residents. Justice Department sued the Alamance County Sheriff's Office for racial discrimination and settled the suit under agreements that changes would be made. Federal authorities ended the 287G agreement in Alamance County. Though no federal or state probes were ever opened on Harrison, in sticking with the program and in the eyes of critics, he found himself in the same class as much maligned anti-immigrant hardliners like Sheriff Tony Johnson of Alamance County and Sheriff Joe Arpaio of Maricopa County, Arizona, who was found to be detaining people without charges for ICE to pick up. A federal judge sentenced to Arpaio to prison for not stopping baseless arrests. A 2016 forum attended by mostly Central American immigrants and reported by the News and Observer, a 13-year-old talked about 287G in terms that it distilled down to what critics really thought and probably what they thought of Harrison. The 13-year-old called 287G a racist program. Despite the studies and lawsuit, the program saw a resurgence in North Carolina in 2020 after ICE created a new kind of agreement for state police officers to execute ICE warrants, following executive orders by former President Donald Trump that enacted his anti-immigrant policies by expanding the program. In 2019 and 2020, 15 state agencies, including the Alamance County Sheriff's Office, signed new agreements to implement the new program. Biden has yet to take action to significantly reduce or end the Trump-era program expansion, though he promised to do so while campaigning, leaving open the possibility of more North Carolina police agencies signing up. That possibility makes Harrison's movement away from the program all the more significant. Or maybe he's recognizing political realities in Wake County. His campaign consultant, Brad Crone, says that the 287G has a stigma of racial profiling. How many Germans, how many French were deported under 287G, asks Crone. The program is an albatross hanging on Harrison's neck. In 2018, current Democratic Sheriff Gerald Baker campaigned on ending the sheriff's office agreement and defeated Harrison by nearly 10%. Biden won Wake County by nearly 30% over Trump 2 years later. The political winds in Wake that saw Harrison to 4 terms as sheriff have changed, but he says it's not politics that are causing him to distance himself from 287G. It's new background-checking technology with the City-County Bureau of Identification. He says the new technology is exactly what I needed. At least I know I won't be letting people back on the streets that are wanted. That's the key right there. City County Bureau books people into jail who are arrested in Wake County. Staff with the Bureau photograph, fingerprint, and identify people. The fingerprinting system is tapped into state and federal databases that can show if a person is wanted on other criminal warrants. Unlike sheriff's offices, with 287G have done, the Bureau does not fingerprint for minor traffic violations, according to its procedures manual. Harrison says that the Bureau's process is universal. Everybody is screened. It doesn't matter race, age, sex, or nationality. Harrison says he won't hold arrested people that ICE wants detained unless presented with a federal warrant. The days of ICE calling, asking for the sheriff's office to hold someone, and the office obliging won't be coming back if Harrison is elected, says Crone. But if ICE or other federal agencies present a warrant, Harrison will hold the person. He says, if elected, we're going to come up with a system, and will everybody agree with it? No. I could care less what people think as long as I know I'm doing the right thing to keep people safe. A day after WRAL reported on August 29 that Harrison no longer supported 287G, immigrant advocates and social justice groups responded. La Fuerza in North Carolina, the ACLU of North Carolina, Advance Carolina, and Emancipate Votes put out a joint statement that says, Harrison's reversal on the sheriff's role in deporting immigrants from Wake County comes too late. While this position change is a step in the right direction, we cannot forget the harm caused by policies he implemented when previously in office. The fact that Harrison says he will honor an ICE warrant if someone who comes into the county jail has such a warrant isn't acceptable in the eyes of those coalition leaders. The statement reads, agreements under 287G are just one way that sheriffs collaborate with ICE, and in fact, a sheriff can help ICE deport people even without a formal contract. Our organizations maintain our unwavering support for our communities and staunch opposition to ICE collaboration of any kind by sheriffs in North Carolina. Willie Rowe, the Democratic contender for Wake County Sheriff, told IndyWeek that the 287 program wasn't cost-effective and did more harm than good. He wouldn't reinstate it, he says. The fiscal cost of the program has been cited as a reason why some counties did away with or never adopted the program. The 2010 UNC study estimated that annually 287G cost Mecklenburg County nearly $5.5 million and Alamance County nearly $5 million. Those costs considered training and salaries for 287G officers as well as the cost of detaining people. Detaining people was by far the highest expense, amounting to about 90% of the entire cost in both those counties. Rowe says, behind the money the program sucks up, it also hinders building trust in communities and building a law enforcement agency that's reflective of the county. Of 287G, Rowe says, it's over with. Now, a very important article by Ben Sessoms. Vote by mail. Any registered voter in North Carolina can vote by absentee ballot through the mail. The midterms are coming, and there are a few ways to vote in North Carolina, from early voting to casting your ballot on election day. But if those don't work for you, voting by mail is an option. Any registered voter in North Carolina, for any reason, can request an absentee ballot to complete and mail to the voter's local board of elections by election day. Here are the details of these voting process in the state. Before you can request a mail-in ballot, you have to register to vote. Pardon me. The deadline for registration is October the 14th. It's in about a month. If you're not registered by then, your only option is same-day registration during early voting from October 20th to November 5th. Once you are registered, you can request an absentee ballot either online or on paper, available in English or Spanish. When requesting an absentee ballot, you must provide your date of birth and either your driver's license number, your official NC Department of Motor Vehicles identification card number, or the last four digits of your Social Security number to verify your identity. That request must be signed by you, the voter, and the voter's near relative or a legal guardian. So that's one of the three, the voter, the voter's near relative, or a legal guardian. Paper requests can be mailed or submit it in person at your county board of elections. Requests must be made by November the 1st, a week before the election day, which is November 8th. If you make a mistake on your absentee ballot, you can contact your board of elections and request a new one. And you can track your mail-in ballot online through Ballot Tracks. Once you fill out your vote on the mail-in ballot, you must either have two people or one notary public witness you marking your ballot. The witnesses don't need to see how you vote. Once again, So you have to get those witnesses or the notary to see you mark. They don't need to see how you vote. Once it's filled out, you seal your ballot and nothing else inside that envelope that will be provided. Sign your name on the back of the envelope. The witnesses will then sign and print their name along with their addresses. Anyone 18 years or older can be a witness unless that person is a candidate. Exceptions include if the candidate is a near relative or guardian, or if the voter is a patient with a disability at a hospital, nursing home, or some other medical facility requesting help from the candidate due to that disability. If you received assistance due to the disability, the assistant must also sign and print their name along with their address. If you need assistance with your ballot, typically only a near relative or verified legal guardian can assist you. If you're unable to read or write and a relative of a guardian can't assist, another person can help you with the ballot. That assistant, however, must fill out the assistance section on the ballot request form. If you have a disability, however, anyone that you choose can assist you in filling out that request form. Patients in a hospital, nursing home, or some other medical facility can request a multi-partisan assistance team, MAT, from the county's Board of Elections to assist them with the mail voting process. If a patient does not have a disability, it is illegal for any owner, manager, director, or employee of the facility, other than the voter's near relative, verifiable legal guardian, or member of an MAT, to request an absentee ballot on behalf of a voter. Once again, it's illegal for any owner, manager, director, or employee of your facility to request that absentee ballot. If a relative or a guardian is not available or a MAT is unavailable to assist within a week, anyone not affiliated with a facility or a political party can assist you with the voting process. Whew. When should I mail by absentee ballot? You must postmark that by Election Day, which is on November 8th this year, and it must be received no later than 5 p.m. on November the 14th. The Board of Education recommends that you mail your ballot well before Election Day. You can also return your ballot in person to your county's Board of Elections or to an early voting site during the early voting period. You can also take it to your Board of Elections office on Election Day, but you must do so by 5 p.m. You cannot submit your absentee ballot at a voting site on Election Day, just the Board of Elections office. Well, that's not complicated at all, is it? That's a whole page of instructions, which you can rehear if you go to IndyWeek.com, or if you re-listen to this broadcast when it becomes available. Well, I'll scattershot some of the remaining time I have, and I'll move over to arts. And this is Indie Week's Fall Arts Preview edition, where they give a sketch of some of the things, major things, coming up. This first portion, which is written by Sarah Edwards and Lena Geller, 7 Can't Miss Fall Concerts. And some of these are coming right up, and some of them actually are through beginning of November, but I'll read them all. Fandango de Durham, That's a lively two-day free-to-the-public event. It's at the Fruit Durham Bottling Company in Durham. It's Wednesday, September 21, and Thursday, September 22. So next week, two-day free-to-the-public event with support from North Carolina Arts Council celebrates the Son Jarocho community-based folk music tradition from Veracruz, Mexico. Wednesday night will feature a performance of Venezuelan and Appalachian folk music by Larry and Joe, and music by Wendy and Tacho Utrera, part of the Los Utrera family band. Thursday, community members can learn the basics of Son Jarocho in a workshop. Now, Saturday, September 24th, over at Coastal Credit Union Music Park in Raleigh, Farm Aid Festival. These are held annually to support American farmers, and they have a legendary past. The first event was organized by Willie Nelson, John Mellencamp, and Neil Young, featured Bob Dylan, B.B. King, and others. Decades later, the festival lands back in Raleigh. The last time it was held in the Triangle was in 2014, and Willie Nelson and Mellencamp will perform alongside Margot Price, Sheryl Crow, Brittany Spencer, and numerous other musicians who straddle country, rock, and blues genres. That's Saturday, September 24th, Farm Aid Festival, and admission and sources for tickets are not given, I beg your pardon, in this article. On Saturday, October the 1st, the North Carolina Museum of Art, again in Raleigh, Watch House with Allison DeGroot and Tatiana Hargreaves, formerly known as Mandolin Orange, Waterhouse, Watching Water, Watching Watch House. It occurs at NCMA. It's taken on the feel of an annual rite of passage as summer turns to fall. North Carolina's favorite folk duo is joined this year by traditional banjo and fiddle musicians Allison DeGroot and Tatiana Hargreaves, who was profiled in a recent indie issue. With a recent sort of kind of fall chill now in the air, it only feels right to pack a blanket and a bottle of wine and plan an evening at the lawn of the Museum of Art, October 1, Saturday. Same day, over at the Poor, P-O-U-R, House and Music Hall in Raleigh, Saturday and Sunday, October 1st and 2nd, the Cooley High Anniversary Show. It's a North Carolina collective. Cooley High has built a repertoire around sonic throwbacks to the golden ages of soul and hip-hop. And now, after more than a decade in the industry, the outfit is so established that it's throwing it back to itself. The two-day anniversary show will commemorate the group's 2011 album, David Thompson, with songs like Dear Raleigh, that are sure to pull on the heartstrings of local listeners. Nance, Jalisa, and Look You Know will complete that lineup. Over to Durham on Saturday, October the 8th, Father John Misty. Josh Tillman, who performs as Father John Misty, is known for giving charismatic performances charged with unexpected moments. At one performance I attended, he swaggered on stage with a bottle of alcohol and proceeded to read from an engaging, if unfinished, manuscript for 20 minutes. Legend also has it that he once wandered off the street and into the Indy Week offices while in Durham for a concert. Luckily, that seems to be what audiences like most about him. For this tour, he returns with new album Chloe and the Next 20th Century, his first new material in 4 years. Anything could happen. That's October 8th, Durham Performing Arts Center, Father John Misty. And on later in October, on the 26th, a Wednesday, Motorco Music Hall in Durham presents Ibibio Sound Machine, songs that blend funk, disco, electronica, afro-punk, and about a dozen other styles. Ibibio Sound Machine has rejected genre limitations, no kidding, in favor of a sound defined primarily by movement. The band, fronted by London-born Nigerian singer Eno Williams, traverses decades of music with its boundless beats and existential refrains, serving up a sonic cocktail that will have folks of all ages breaking it down on the dance floor. Ibibio Sound Machine's fall tour will feature songs from its latest album, Electricity, released this year on Durham-based label Merge Records. Pop duo Terror Jr. opens that program on Wednesday, October 26th at Motor Co. And the final concert listed here as a preview on Monday, November 7th, over in Saxapaha at the Haw River Ballroom, Plains, a brunette alt-country duo composed of musicians Katie Crutchfield and Jess Williamson has only released two songs ahead of its multi-city fall tour, but the strength of those two songs and the tacit strength of both musicians' soulful country rock prowess has been enough to pave the way for a packed tour. Plains' Stop in the Triangle also has a bit of a hometown feel. Waxahachie, that's Crutchfield's group, has signed to Durham label Merge, and Durham's Brad Cook produced the duo's debut album, I Walked With You A Ways, and that album drops on October the 14th. So this Monday at the Haw River Ballroom in Saxapaha, November the 7th. Well, I'm going to actually move to theater, stage and theater articles now. Not everyone is confined to simply reading books at home, and there is a book. There's an article here about 10 upcoming new books from the North Carolina in the Indie Week, which one could find. But this article by Byron Woods is called "Stage Right: Five New Groups Join the Switchyard Theater Company," giving the Durham theater scene a groundswell of new growth. Why do people start theater groups? For Beth Brody, it was the largely ignored fact that institutional mental health care has worsened significantly in the U.S. since the 1960s. For David Berberian, it was noting that independent theater had no steady home in Durham in recent years. And Naomi Kraut just needed something, anything, to help her cope with being a mom homeschooling her kids in a pandemic. These and other artists are all part of a groundswell in regional theater, dance, and live arts communities this fall as five new groups join Switchyard Theater in mounting productions, which run through November. Brody says about her current revival of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest for LGB productions, "I think the mental health crisis in America is hugely overlooked. 60 years later, we're still flying over the cuckoo's nest." The Durham theater scene has been scattered since Man Bites Dog Theater 2018 transitioned from a company that produced and hosted artists at its space on Foster Street to a grants organization devoted to funding new works. Berberian says, "Everybody's sort of been jumping around from space to space, whatever they can find." Redbird Theater, the company he co-founded with Derek Ivey and Jerry Schulke, plans its flag with a September 29th launch party and subsequent first season of works at the Durham Bottling Company. The move is intended, quote, "to bring back that sense of community that Man Bites embodied. Part of that means having your own space where people know you're going to be." After a decade-long sojourn at a small-town theater in Texas, Wake Forest native Cora Hemphill returned determined to start a company in her hometown where actors are paid to do professional-level work. Firebox Theater, which she started with director Tim Arts, bows this week with two one-acts that take audiences from a cold Iowa farmhouse in 1910 to a small Texas jail cell several decades later. Hemphill says, "I've seen how a theater can enrich a community, and I want so much for this town to experience that richness." During the pandemic, then student director Emma Zuba stumbled upon a realization when necessity forced her to stage The Two Gentlemen of Verona with six actors in 60 minutes with minimal props and costumes. She recalls, "We found a way to keep it small and scrappy and safe and effective, and audiences really responded to it. Thus was born the idea of Scrap Paper Shakespeare, an ongoing experiment we'll see in a late September production of Julius Caesar. It's going to be small and simple, she says. The beauty of Shakespeare is in the words. Before the pandemic, Kraut was an education professor at Duke. Then COVID hit, and boom, she was homeschooling kids. She recalls the shocking headlines during the lockdown about how hard the pandemic was hitting mothers. But that's always been a part of America all the time, Kraut says. Just as a way to survive, I started writing down things they were saying and I was thinking at the time. Then Kraut started making songs with her bass guitar. Then she started recording them. The puppets came next, characters who performed the songs. After that, the music videos like COVID Test and Zoom School is the Worst on YouTube. Almost before she knew it, Kraut had made a puppet musical, the very worst puppet musical, to be exact. A live performance is in the works. Her latest addition to the musical, releasing this week, deals with aging. When you're a new mom, society showers you and you have the glow. Then you just turn into the annoying butt of all jokes. It's always open season, and it's just getting worse. The 10-minute video is called Advanced Maternal Rage. Its premiere drops during a Thursday night Bull City Summit party at Ruby's on Five Points. And I'll just reconnect the dates on the groups of this, and you can reconnect with that again on IndieWeek.com. September 15th, today, at 9 p.m., Ruby's on Five Points at the Advanced Maternal Rage Fun Mom Band. And the 15th, during to the 15th to the 25th, Firebox Theater, Hello Out There, and Trifles. That's at the Cotton Company at Wake Forest. At the Jewish Community Center in Durham, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, again, tonight through the 18th. And that Julius Caesar Scrap Paper Shakespeare is in Raleigh at the Back to One Studios, September 30 through October 2nd. And Fuddy Mears Switchyard Theater Company is at Burning Coal, October 20 through 28th. And A Doll's House, Part 2, Redbird Theater, Durham Bottling Company in Durham, November 11th through the 19th. Well, this has been a word-packed episode of Indie Week, and I apologize for my voice giving out maybe sooner than it should, but I'm John Federson, and this production from the North Carolina Reading Service is available as a podcast if you want to revisit any of it. And again, IndieWeek.com, available online to see these articles and the ones I did not have a chance to complete. So once again, thank you very much for listening. And from IndieWeek, from the Independent, John Federson says, farewell for now.